Facundo here, and this week's guest is a very fascinating one, because he smokes, and he drinks, and he often does both at the same time. It's very rare to observe a man who can place beer bottle and cigarette simultaneously in his orifice, with the liquid and smoke trailing down two separate throat passages, and all this while breathing, and in Mr. Amos's case, writing a novel. So I can get behind Martin Amos, because I can trust a multitasker along these lines. Smoking and drinking aren't conducted nearly enough in our society. You might almost say that there are Stalin-esque safeguards hindering these natural debaucheries.
So I am here with Martin Amos, author of Money, The Information, Cobra the Dread, and most recently, House of Meetings. Martin, how are you doing today?
I'm not too bad, thanks.
I wanted to first of all talk about your sort of relationship with Russia. This is the sort of second major book about Russia. You authored another book called Cobra the Dread, in which you offered your credentials by saying, I am a 52-year-old novelist and critic who has recently read several yards of books about the Soviet experiment. I'm wondering, what spawned this sort of desire to read several yards of books? How did this come about?
Well, there's a few elements. One is that my father was a communist in his youth and went on being a communist till 1956 in Hungary, the failed rebellion in Hungary. Until I was seven, I was living in a kind of communist household. Not that I remember it being very terroristic or anything like that. No famines or beatings or tortures. But it did make me wonder, you know, why he went on that late when there was already enough unignorable evidence that the Soviet experiment had gone horribly wrong. So I was interested in that. And then when I began to look into it, 1917 onwards to 53, the death of Stalin, one of the most incredible, you know, psychotic breaks in human history, just the horror and dynamism of that experiment. It was like an addiction. I've never been so fascinated in all my life. And then also the other element, which emerges more in the novel House of Meetings than the kind of journalistic or amateur historian book, Cobra the Dread, was a fascination with the Russian character, which goes back to my teenage years and reading Dostoevsky and later Tolstoy and Gogol and all the rest. Just, you know, what is this Russian curse? And that in particular emerged when I came to write this novel. Just, you know, it's not about the Soviet Union, although it's about life in the gulag and all that. It's more about the Russian predicament and curse.
Gotcha. Now, you originally intended this book to sort of appear with a few additional pieces that you had authored in The New Yorker. And this doesn't seem entirely characteristic of you, because you're normally not such a sort of hesitant guy. What kind of made you sort of shift to actually putting it in one volume? I know that the reception for Yellow Dog was not entirely good, what with the Tibor Fischer review and whatnot. How did that phase you in any way?
Or? Yeah, it did a bit. It's not nice to, in England at any rate, it wasn't just, there were several very good reviews, but the bulk of them weren't, and it wasn't just the reviews. I mean, anyone who could hold a pen was queuing up to write, you know, some exultant piece about, you know, crawl away and die, you know, saying, you know, all we can do now is pity him and all this sort of thing. Oh, nice to have your pity, mate. I particularly value your pity. To feel such dislike centered on you and centered on your book. I mean, I've been written about, you know, far from sympathetically for quite some time, but it was all right when they were just having a go at me and my character and my activities. But when they attack your book, it's in those terms, it's much more painful. It's like watching your child being scragged in the schoolyard. I think wouldn't have been human to have not felt that and felt it as a blow, you know, to your confidence, which is what it really is intended to be. You know, as I think Baudelaire said, if you're a writer, all you have is your opinion of yourself and your talent and your reputation, and that puts food on the table. You know, that's your livelihood, is your opinion of yourself. So I think, yeah, I think my confidence was affected by it, but it was more the struggle of this particular book, and I was so uncertain of my right to do it, of my legitimacy to write about a victim, two victims of a state autocracy. I'd written a novel about the Holocaust, Times Arrow, but that was written from the point of view of a perpetrator, a Nazi doctor. So it was much, you know, less complicated to do that. But to write about a victim while living in Uruguay in subtropical splendor with my beautiful wife and beautiful daughters, with the sea lapping at the garden gate, and it was, it just didn't feel right. And it wasn't till the novel was written and I was reading it in proof that I thought, actually, this is fine, this is all right. I came out of that struggle. And so I the stories I'd attached to it fore and aft were really just to protect it, because I thought it couldn't stand on its own two feet. And I also thought it was shorter than it was. I thought it was a novella, really. But it's not. It's a you know, slightly short novel, but nothing out of the way. So then I, at very much the last minute, said I want this to be by itself, because for some reason books of stories just don't make an impact, because people don't like stories because they have to stop and start. You know, they get used to some characters, and then it's got to get used to some more characters. You know,
plus there's a very sort of hit or miss quality sometimes to some short story collections that maybe people reading the book might have sort of come with preconceived notions of what the material was all about.
Yeah, I mean it was a coherent book in that it had a common theme, although the two stories, one was about Mohammed Atta, and the other was about, as it might be, one of the doubles for Saddam Hussein. So it was terror and boredom was actually the collective title I was close to giving it. And, you know, the Soviet arrangement was one of terror and boredom. Everything was boring. Any interesting subject was so hopelessly controversial that no one dared do it. There was no philosophy done in Stalin's time because it was too controversial, and you'd get arrested, and you'd get killed and tortured, and so would your family. And the newspapers were boring, the radio was boring, all conversation was boring except in your family, because everyone was an informer. That was the twin pillar, was terror and boredom. And I feel in the post-September the 11th world that the boredom quotient has shot up, because I don't just mean airport queues and watching your daughter's fluffy toys being palpated by a security official. Don't mean all that. I mean this confrontation we're now in with the dependent mind, you know, the religious mind, where we have nothing in common with it. We have nothing we can argue about. It's no different from having dinner with a fanatical Christian. You know, all your higher faculties of reason and deduction just have to close down because you're with someone whose assumptions you don't share. So it was coherent, but I wanted the book to stand alone, and think it does.
Did you see sort of parallels between Stalinism and sort of this religious mind that you're referring to here?
Yeah. I mean, ideology is a religion. And religion is an ideology. It's the same. It's a belief system. And by its very nature, violent. And I think the reason for that is that if you subscribe to an ideology or religion, same thing, you're committing yourself to illusion, because no one idea explains everything. And if you commit yourself to an illusion, whenever that illusion is threatened or affronted or challenged, then you can't defend it with mind alone, with argument alone. How can you? So your fists tighten, and you're in the world of violence straight away.
So was it the world of violence that kind of, maybe you saw in Stalinism this world of violence, that perhaps there are some parallels to the kind of world of violence we live in today, or...
Yeah, and the inanity of it, that the Bolshevik ideology became, you know, the fabric of life. You breathed it every second, and so did your children from, you know, from cradle to grave. This was the bullshit that you mouthed and pretended to subscribe to, and until you did. You know, someone characterized life in the Soviet Union saying, half-starved people, you know, staggered around and talked about how their system was better than any other, and would soon bury capitalism, and they half believed it. You know, you lose the faculty for sincerity, even to yourself. And the religious idea is, of course, even more consuming, because it assumes the second order of existence, which begins after death. Therefore, it's demoting the existence that you and I are humbly going through every day. A phase of existence described by the Ayatollah Khomeini as the scum of existence. You know, the life we know is scum, and that it only starts to get any good once you're dead. So, I mean, a very consuming and savage ideology, the Islamist one. And that's, you know, what we now confront.
Well, let's talk specifically about House of Meetings, because there are a number of very interesting things going on. I wanted to actually ask you about the protagonist, who you do not name, and who actually, in a certain kind of way, parallels the life of Stalin, in the sense that he, or rather, I almost sort of kind of drew a parallel between him and Yakov, Stalin's first son, in the sense that he has two mothers. And you've kind of given him an extra sort of twin brother. I was wondering if that was sort of an intentional aspect of you, and maybe you can sort of talk about these kind of quasi-allegorical sort of things that happen within House of Meetings.
That hasn't occurred to me that it was parallel Stalin's life. In fact, this is the least tricksy novel I've ever written. It's the most, you know, social realism of a kind of 19th century sort. There aren't any unreliable narrators or anything of that kind, or double time schemes. This is very straight. And I see him as a character brutalized by Stalin and by the war, which, you know, wasn't Stalin's fault. But I don't see him as a sort of, you know, lower form of Stalin. No, he stands by himself.
Does he represent, though? I guess I sort of saw this sort of parallel because he lives very much through the beginning of Stalinism all the way pretty much to after Stalin's death, and this kind of lingering ideology in the air. Was this, and also we didn't touch upon this notion of him being sort of unnamed, and I suppose that his lack of name sort of suggested this virulent kind of ideology that is just kind of infiltrating this country with 12 time zones and lavishing it with all manner of just, you know, expectations that can't actually be identified. It can't even actually be spoken about. Was this one of the reasons, perhaps some of the reasons maybe, why you kind of did not name him, or just...
No, it was more simple and instinctive than that, in that when I'd written the first draft, I realized that he was only named once, only needed his name once. And I thought, he doesn't want a name. And my model and hero while I was writing this book was Joseph Conrad and Under Western Eyes, where, again, the hero isn't named. And so I thought, he doesn't want a name, and Conrad didn't give his one a name. So let's... I don't know if anything is gained by it, but it just felt right for this. And many decisions when you're writing are just to do with instinct and inkling, and not really anything you can defend.
The other interesting thing about his narration is that when he speaks, his words are not in quotes, but all the other characters around him are in quotes. When did this particular stylistic decision kind of make itself known?
Yeah, again, wonder if anything is gained, but it... it made me feel much more comfortable if what he says is not wasn't surrounded by quotes. Mm-hmm. Although it was fine when other people spoke. And I don't know what it was. He gives a reason for it. He says that he's an Anglophile, and he says it's a bit British of him, he knows, but he feels it's bad form to quote himself.
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like to me, sort of not quite right, you know. And I'm now writing an autobiographical novel, and I actually feel the same urge to remove quotation marks from the main character, just because it's something a little bit more modest about it if you do it that way.
Well, it also becomes more embedded within the actual text itself.
Yeah. Yeah. It took a bit of, you know, local ingenuity to do it, but I just felt right to do it that way.
I wanted to actually touch upon this idea of social realism, this being a sort of sparser novel. You're a novelist who's noted for very really extraordinary style, a particular sort of imprint within all of your books. It's not entirely gone, but I wanted to kind of ask you how much of a struggle it was to kind of just really sort of remove the temptation to sort of play with words that is in almost every single one of your other books.
It's true also of Time's Arrow, the book about the Holocaust. You don't want to do pyrotechnics when you're writing about something as grave as that. But I think it is as well written as anything I've done, in a different kind of way, in that the rhythms are, you know, I worked as hard on getting those rhythms right, and it's just a graver kind of rhythm, but just as measured and worked at as anything else I've written, but not exuberant. You know, you can't be exuberant on these subjects.
Well, even the first part of Time Zero has a really comic impulse to it, in the sense of living backwards and all these, the perception being completely shifted. Initially, sort of played for laughs, and then we reveal its inevitability. Mm. So, laying off the comic sensibilities, what was this like to you? I mean, did you feel that you... Because, I mean, you have written books like The Information, for example, where you've just taken on any number of targets without any hindrance of conventions. You're something of an iconoclast. Was there ever a temptation to sort of make light of this situation?
I don't agree that it's not funny. I think it's not laugh-out-loud funny, but I think it is grimly funny.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, because... deeply absurd situation, and I was hoping to find a kind of Russian register for the humor that he talks about, which is a humor of squalor and cynicism, mm-hmm. where you've seen it all so many times. It's a sort of a bitter, weary humor, but I think it is there. Perhaps the story has enough forward push to, so that you're sort of always moving on and don't notice it so much. But it has its, you know, the right amount of humor, has its fair share of humor.
Well, any book that has the phrase mirthless rictus, you know, isn't exactly entirely meant to be played seriously. I want to actually ask you about how there seems to have been a number of contemporary books in the last few years, particularly after September 11th, that have dealt with the notion of the Soviet experiment. William T. Volman's Europe Central, the James Meeks's The People's Act of Love, even Mark Miller wrote this interesting parallel universe of Superman called Red Sun, where Superman actually lands in Stalinist Russia. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts. You should read it. It's actually really interesting. Do you have any thoughts on why there's this sudden reassessment in fiction of the evils of Stalinism?
I don't know any of the books you've mentioned, although they sound very interesting. But I think it's the same thing that happened about when the time I wrote Time's Arrow. There was also the Mouse by Art Spiegelman, and Life is Beautiful, is it, the film, where the sort of comic film about the Holocaust. I think what has happened is that the survivors of the Gulag, although the Gulag limped on into the Gorbachev's time, it was really ended in the 60s as a slave system. And I think as the last survivors of that historical experience die out, then there's a slight release of energy and an ability to come at it from different directions. And a sense that you can now even play with it a bit. Mm-hmm. And those great icons of the Holocaust, which would be, you know, the rail track and the watchtower, and indeed, you know, the emaciated corpses and all the rest. They're still there, and they're still as powerful as ever. But they need a kind of refreshment from a generation that wasn't alive during that time.
It's sort of comparable then to some of the second generation Holocaust books.
Yeah. And things that have come up. Yeah, and I think the same. It went on a bit later than the Holocaust, so it's on schedule to happen now. You know, 10 years after. 10 years after the same thing happened to the Holocaust, it's now happening to the Gulag. And the Gulag is tremendously under-remembered and under-honored, I think. And that was certainly, you know, in as much as you had any kind of pro bono feeling about writing a novel, you could tell yourself that as I was struggling to find the legitimacy, I could say, you know, it is important that these dead awaken in our minds.
Well, I wanted to actually go back to the notion of writing a sparse novel that was not as flamboyant as your other ones. I'm going to actually give you a few reviews that I sort of looked at. James Marcus in the Los Angeles Times had an interesting thing to say. He suggested that for the name of Phoenix, that the narrator's American wife, that you deserve a long moment in the dunk tank because it's such a blunt metaphor. And I'm wondering if there's a certain sort of point to that, if this kind of maybe works against the notion of writing as a war against cliché. Was this a sort of circumstance where you needed to kind of ride the, this is it, it's Phoenix or Venus or like?
But what's the problem with Phoenix? And he points out that he liked her name for that reason, but she doesn't do any, she is not reborn in the novel in any kind of way. Venus is, did he get that Venus is black?
No, he didn't actually.
Well, you know, well, fuck him, because that might have made it a bit more palatable. These are just the names that presented themselves to me, and they're fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Who's meant to be reborn in this novel? No one is reborn in it. Yeah. I mean, you could say of her history that she, as he does say, that it included several rebirths because it's a cyclical rebirth. But no, it's not underlining anything, you know.
But in terms of like opting for sort of really direct names like this, as opposed to, you know, riffing on them as I've seen in your previous work, was this sort of, I guess, in terms of like wanting to labor over a sentence and make it unlike anything else that is out there, was this something of a struggle for you, or was this a matter of, because you're having to downshift somewhat into a really grave territory?
No, I mean, there are no outside influences when you're writing. I'm not worried about anything, anyone looking over my shoulder. This is no different from any other book. I'm writing to express what I want to say as rhythmically and as exactly as possible. And I write a sentence and I say it in my head until it feels right, and that's it. There are no other considerations involved.
M. John Harrison also had an interesting comment about this book, and he observed that Amos will go the long way around to avoid a cliché. Sometimes he will coagulate from trying too hard, and sometimes he will be a pedant. All this to be expected. Did you find yourself, with this observation in mind, sometimes going the long way to sort of capture this world at all? Or?
No. People think I'm trying to second-guess them, but I'm not. I'm just, it's an internal process. I'm not trying to, you know, outsmart my critics or anything of that kind. I'm just doing, you know, what comes naturally to me. It's not a self-conscious process. It's not done for effect. It's done to satisfy my inner ear, and that's it.
So for you, the reader or the critical community, is it any kind of consideration as you're writing a book?
No, never has been. You know, you're aware that it's there, and you're very slightly at its mercy. But, you know, it's funny because even quite sympathetic critics say that, assume that you're somehow in a pas de deux with the critical community. And when I wrote Night Train, someone said he's showing that he can do a female narrator. I'm not showing anything. You know, I'm just writing my next novel. That's all.
But there's also sort of, well, there's another review I'm going to mention, and then that will be it for the review excerpts. But Thomas Mallon, writing in the Washington Post, observed that the book's bravura moments cause readers to too often feel themselves hearing not the gulag survivor, but the accomplished novelist. Again, this goes back to the notion of this voice of this narrator who is smitten, obviously, with poetry. There's references to Andrew Marvel. He calls himself an Anglophile. Was this, again, sort of a struggle for you to get this kind of, you know, exotic patois that you couldn't quite access as readily as, say, you know, a dart player?
Yeah, it was a bit. And I had to shape his character and even his history to make him the man who could write this kind of English. But again, you know, who's it meant to sound like? It's a part of me. You know, all your characters are a part of you. They're not from some other sensibility. I could, of course, you know, purge the prose of any interest at all to make it more realistic in that sense. But, you know, why do that? This is, I don't care if you can tell it's by me. It is by me. You know, who else is it meant to sound like? I don't. Some very good novels have been written where, you know, you have a novel written by someone who's very stupid, for instance. This isn't something that's ever going to interest me. I want to be able to write flat out, you know, at the tip of what I can do. And I'll settle for loss of verisimilitude to do that. In this case, I made him such an Anglophile, and I made him, you know, even his love life is determined by an interest in the English language. And so I turn him into the kind of man who could have written this book. So it was difficult in that sense. But
was this kind of easier for you to sort of access this by making him such an Anglophile and such a sort of poet of doggerel of his own confession? But did this kind of, you know, allow you to sort of really kind of access it? Was it sort of like kind of almost sort of a middleman, so to speak, by making him this Anglophile?
Yeah, I mean, it was a consideration, but I think it makes him more, not less, interesting. His mastery of English has to be, and it is kind of comic and competitive, you know. He almost laughs himself into a heart attack when he comes across a solecism in Lolita.
Yeah.
Because he's braying about his own superiority, and he says that. But this is, you know, a minor thread in the novel. And
well, it's interesting too, because he also places poetry in the same categories as avarice and lust. So it's almost as if this kind of, I was viewing it through the prism of this sort of representation of Russian culture through Stalinism, and it's almost as if this kind of stifled impulse that poetry is sort of, you know, base in some way. Was this something that
Poetry is base.
Poetry is sort of, I guess, baser than it would be, say, if he had actually managed to escape from the gulag, and he was actually able to sort of set himself up earlier in America when he actually returns. He, by his own confession, he's just saying that this is just, you know, this is fairly petty, and I'm just this, as he says, like a very much rowdier version of the Ancient Mariner, you know.
Yeah, but I don't get the poetry part of the question.
Well, the poetry part of the question, there's so much poetic references in this book, and yet he also compares poetry to avarice and lust.
No, he doesn't. When does he do that?
He says, describing it, I believe, when he's describing his sister?
Oh, no, no, I know what you mean. He says, yeah, Avison Lust took up most of my free time and poetry.
Yes.
But I mean, in contrast to Avison Lust, yes, and poetry, he says, meaning it's surprising, but that this is true.
Okay.
It's not the same level. It's this is a sort of redeeming feature of what he's
right
doing. It's not it's anomalous in a way, but you know, because it was the brother who wanted to be the poet, but in fact he's passionate about poetry, and we should, you know, register that. And it's Lev who quotes Mandelstam, who says that how you respond to poetry is the measure of your humanity. This is not something that strikes much of a chord these days,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Because poetry is dying now.
I guess through a sort of ironic prism, in the sense that he has poetry here, but maybe it is an escape because he's so embittered, particularly during the conclusion of the book. I suppose I viewed it as a kind of, I guess, ironic, sort of self-deluding kind of sort of statement that he's making. I mean, with your books, sometimes I
No, but I mean, you know, when you first see him, he's got Coleridge on his lap, and
yeah.
Early quote from Auden, and he's obviously someone for whom this does matter, you know. And I, in fact, toyed with the idea of making him a sort of amateur or you know, little magazine critic of poetry. That this is part of him, and anomalous, you know, that's, you know, very Russian, weird, you know, perverse.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the way that you employ sort of often Greek mythological references in your book. In this, you have Venus, you have the doctor whose name Janus, which I thought was a funny little thing, although it may have been indebted to the author that you quoted in your acknowledgments.
I never thought of him as Janus for an instant. Also, what's so mythological about Venus?
Well,
she's the goddess of love,
yes.
and that is significant. But
sure.
You know, it's there if you want it, but it's not, your face isn't thrust into it, you know, it's...
But you follow up, like, the introduction of Janus with these references to sight, which made me sort of think of, basically, maybe these people are looking at the gulag through sort of one-eyed. That's kind of how I sort of observed it. And I was also thinking in light of the information where you have Demeter as in that as well. And I'm wondering if this is your way of sort of... incorporating mythological references into books, because a lot of contemporary literature seems to have almost abandoned,
forgotten.
Yeah,
all that.
Exactly.
I'm not tremendously up on all that. It's just that I just have this belief that since a name in a book is going to take up, you know, 0.0001% of the whole, it ought to be doing some work, you know. I don't want to have characters called Tom Metfield and, you know, Jim Davis, you know, those are dead names. You've got to have a little shot of vitality in these names, and not all the time, you know. You've got to have modulation as well, but if the name's going to come up, it's going to be doing some work.
Well, actually, I wanted to actually ask you about the notion of Russia as a hangover that the narrator experiences in the present day, or rather 2004, was... Did the hangover sort of come naturally to you, or as a metaphor, or it was one of these things that kind of...
Oh, you mean the hangover he has?
Yes. Or how much of it, maybe I'm looking at it too metaphorically, I don't know.
No, that's, again, just felt right, but come to think of it, and it's always that way around, come to think of it,
yeah.
Russia is in the sort of hangovers, in the post-post stage, you know, it's post-industrial, it's what happens after. And also the idea that when you get that old, you know, you just can't, there isn't any room for a hangover, and it's just to encumber him and make him sort of grouchier than usual for the last run.
It's one thing that's interesting I wanted to actually ask you about, that is that as a guy who is like in his 80s, he has a pretty good memory. how much of this memory can we actually truly believe? He's also extremely articulate, because sometimes older people can't always remember the details, or they're stumbling upon a word.
Yeah.
I don't think he really confesses too much in this book that I can recall of memories sort of disappearing. I'm wondering why you avoided this issue.
That's right, and it is an issue. And Nadezhda Mandelstam said that most survivors of the Gulag, all their memories have been baked into an impenetrable mass. You know, but no, he's an exceptionally vigorous man, and he had to be that because he commits suicide in a way at the end of the book.
Yeah.
And you have to feel that there was real life to be extinguished, that he wasn't sort of pathetic, doddering. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, he's exceptionally vigorous. And the vigor with which he survives the whole thing, whereas his brother is physically ruined as well as spiritually ruined. So I always had this idea of him being, you know, impressively compos mentis and physically still strong. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's nothing to sort of give up at the end. There's nothing to sacrifice at the end. His death is slightly sacramental. He's dying where his brother died. It's his apology to his brother. It's his reckoning with his brother.
It's almost like a migratory cycle to some degree.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Well, I actually skipped one very interesting sort of thing, and I actually wanted to address the notion of the similarities between House of Meetings and Cope of the Dread. Zoya, in this, now pardon if I mispronounce this, but you bring up in Cope of the Dread, Zoya Kozmodemyanskaya?
Yeah.
Zoya in House of Meetings bears a very striking resemblance to this real-life Zoya. There's also the Russian cross, the correlating X between birth rates and death rates that carries over into both books. I'm wondering, to what extent was House of Meetings a way for you to sort of reframe some of the issues that you were exploring in Cope of the Dread?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I did the first draft, there were quite a few overlaps between, and there's, I don't think, by the end, there's practically nothing that's used twice.
Yeah.
But I certainly had Zoya Kozmodemyanskaya in mind, the Jewish martyr, only in that she's Jewish and she's sort of at risk and endangered. But it was the faintest of echoes, and no one else has. One other Russian lady asked about it, mm-hmm. but no one else has mentioned it. It's not, you know, it's sort of optional that, but. No, it had for me a kind of emotional charge, and sometimes that's what they're there for. It's not a hint for the intricate kind of scholarly reader. It's just to solidify your own feeling about her.
Sort of a point of authenticity for you to actually carry out this story, or
a little bit, yeah. And it was hard to feel that, you know. It was a fight to feel authentic about it, and you know, you've seen those satiric cartoons of best-selling novelists sitting by the swimming pool with a cocktail and typing, you know, on the next day the third child died, you know, while calling for another cocktail. You know, maybe some people can do that. I couldn't do it. I had to really fight to win the right to do it.
But you were also in this really very nice locale
yeah.
when you wrote this.
Yeah,
what steps did you take to really kind of, I guess, embrace misery?
I didn't. They were all done for me. I mean, every writer knows what they are. They're the sufferings of the study, not of the gulag, but of the study. So that every morning you went in there and you felt you were starting from scratch every time, and the unconscious was helping you not at all. You had to maul it together every day, mm-hmm. and you thought, Christ, this book is begging me to abandon it. It doesn't want to be written by me, this book. And just, you have to keep at it, and it was horrible. And I got to the point where I actually ceased to think of myself as a writer. I thought,
really?
I thought, that's all gone now.
So did House of Meetings germinate in this long period between Yellow Dog and now, did you have to sort of work yourself up to a point where you could really tackle House of Meetings? Or
I spent more than a year on the novel I'm now quite close to finishing.
Okay.
And that kind of got stalled too, and it was a sort of crisis really. And then I started this. I wrote Mohammed Atta, and that was a relief, and it was, I felt the sort of pleasure of composition and again. But with this, it was the subject matter. With the other one, it was just the angle or the direction. But this, it was just, I can't go in there. I can't. I'm not qualified to write about this. And so after a year of feeling like shit, I was. I mean, I'd done it and was out the other side of it. And then suddenly I was, I must say, very impressed by what I'd done. But it was the end of a long road.
Did it take more yards of books, or what did it take to sort of get yourself to that place where you knew you could do this?
Well, I didn't know until I'd done it. I mean, I felt awful about it till about the last couple of weeks. And hardly dared look at the proofs when they came, you know, and then did look at the proofs. And I had the feeling that this was written by someone else. I mean, unlike Shithead over there, but didn't feel it was very like me at all.
Yeah.
It felt as though I'd got access to a different voice. It's still me, but, you know, obviously me, but it just, yeah. It felt ventriloquial in fact.
Do you feel, though, that when you sort of really kind of, I guess if we were to imagine a kind of hypothetical sliding calibrator of some sort, in which Martin Amis Pure is like at the top, and then like this really sort of anti-Martin Amis is at the bottom, how far on this hypothetical sort of calibrator could you go and feel this sort of sense of comfort in terms of, like, you know, pursuing a novel? Is there just some sort of bare minimum that you need of Martin Amisness?
Well, I mean, I don't know what this Martin Amis is, because it's just meanness, you know. It's just me. I didn't think I could write. If you'd asked me the year before I wrote Times Arrow who's the least likely Western novelist to write a novel about the Holocaust, I'd have said me. Yeah. But suddenly an idea comes to you, or a feeling comes to you, the Nabokovian throb comes to you, and then it's a challenge between you and that idea, and what Updike calls the sort of the million points of resistance between the initial throb and the finished thing, things you have to get past, the points of resistance, good phrase. And if I get that throb, then I will, you know, do everything in my power to get past the points of resistance and write the thing. You know.
But it also seems to me that you experience what William Gibson has observed. There's this famous story where basically every time William Gibson works on a novel, he basically, you know, he's like, this is the worst thing I've ever written. And his wife essentially tells him, oh, yeah, you said that about the last book. Is this kind of a case with you? Or?
Except I would never say anything like that, even to my wife. I wouldn't. No, it's got, you have to keep it stoppered down. Yeah. No emoting about it. You know, you have to, or has to churn around inside you. And during the worst times, my wife would say, how's it going out there? Because my study was at the other end of the garden. I'd say, fine. In a sort of, you know, don't ask me about it. Didn't even want to talk about it. Just sort of, it was just all too raw and tender, the whole thing.
I actually wanted to actually ask you about the relationship between delving into politics and these comic books, I mean, comic novels, rather, of yours. Is there some sort of part of you that kind of, when you're working on something so intense, like House of Meetings, that you miss this, you know, delving into some sort of comic meditation, like The Information, like Money, or anything like that?
No, because, I mean, you're having your more humorous thoughts and making note of them in a notebook for use in the next novel, perhaps, when you are going to, you know, you're going to be, I intend to be funny about what it's like getting older. So it's just that they're put on hold, all those, the lighter thoughts, or the prettier thoughts even, and just, you know, wait their turn. But it's all a question of decorum, really, that you have to pitch the prose at a have to give it the weight and the reverberation that the subject demands. That's really the fight.
Well, Martin Amis, thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Didn't anybody tell you? Didn't anybody tell you how to gracefully disappear in a room? I know you put in the hours to keep me in sunglasses, I know. And so now I'm sorry I missed you. I had a secret meeting in the basement of my brain.